his front teeth out with a flathead screwdriver. But if he were lying, he would be more committed, somber, even. He was not smart enough to lie casually. "Captain Hollows," announced the Fed. "If you have any questions, I encourage you to ask them. Mr. McKee's made me so tired with his cerebral impairment that I can't trust myself not to slap his mouth if I continue to conduct the interview." Vega extended her neck like a weed, trying to reach the light, listening. "Yes, I have some questions," said Hollows. "Where did you say you met Evan Marsh for the first time?" Vega heard the creak of the mattress as McKee moved around. "Stag's Bar on 7th. When was that?" "I don't know. Year ago?" "And how did you get to know each other?"
"What do you mean?"
said McKee, confused.
"In my experience," said Hollows, "drug addicts get to know each other because they buy drugs together, sell them together, do them together. It's like a burrow of rats sharing the same pile of garbage. And Denville's not a big place. So, did you and Evan Marsh share that type of relationship?"
Vega smiled. Hollows could sound sanctimonious and bitchy reading a grocery list, and she recognized that it probably made him good at his job.
"Yeah, sure, we bought from the same guys," said McKee. "You traveled in the same circles," said Hollows. "Yeah," said McKee, sounding exhausted from the repetition. "Yes. So how exactly would Evan Marsh meet Kylie Brandt if these were the types of people he was associating with?"
McKee was quiet.
"I'll rephrase that," said Hollows, ever more condescending. "Where would a little girl meet two dumb junkies like you and Evan Marsh?" "I don't know, man," said McKee, angry and annoyed. "At a party or some shit. I wasn't there."
Vega pictured a room. Beige walls and beige floors. No furniture, no windows. There was Kylie in her party dress on one side. There was Evan Marsh in jeans and a t-shirt on the other. No one else.
"Come on, John," said Hollows. "Where would that party be? You think Marsh went to her middle school dance?"
Vega filled in the room. Flat-screen TV. Cardboard box for a coffee table. One black cat with white paws. She touched the bandage above her eye, and the ache rushed across her brow.
"One of Marsh's hookups," said McKee. "He was buying and she was there."
In her head, a blue needle moved across the spiking red sound waves on an audio memo. A scratchy voice saying, "I had clients here. People get freaked out. They see a kid."
"That's what he told you?" Hollows said, skeptical. "Yeah, that's what he told me. The fuck I know!"
McKee shouted, banging his fist into the bottom of his food tray. Back in Vega's room, Evan Marsh, Charlie Bright, guys who looked like one or either of them, doubled and tripled, smoking weed, drinking beer, counting money. And then Evan and Kylie in the corner of the room, talking, getting to know each other in the few minutes it took for Evan Marsh to get hold of a bad idea. And for Alex Cheney to get his keys, so he could drive Kylie back home. They were in Trainer's SUV, Junior driving with Trainer sitting shotgun, twisting his body so he could talk to the passengers in the back seat, Cap and the Fed, with Vega between them like the little sister on a road trip. Vega's thigh was lined up against Cap's, the warmth blocked by the fabric of their pants, but it crossed his mind his palm could likely span the width of her leg, that she was actually far more delicate than either of them wanted to think. She reminded him of birds he would see hanging on the feeder Nell had strung in the backyard a few winters back, puffing out feathers to protect brittle bodies. On the way out of the hospital, The administrator and a gray-faced doctor stopped them and made Vega sign a form, saying they weren't responsible for the consequences of her removing her own IV and releasing herself. The doctor gave her a Band-Aid for the spot on her hand where the IV needle had been, and told her there might be irritation where they'd administered the tetanus booster in her arm. He told her to keep the wound on her forehead clean and change the dressing once a day. Vega seemed bored by the instructions, took the pen impatiently from the administrator, and scrawled AV on the black line. To Cap, she looked smaller, her head bowed, taking careful tightrope steps to the car. Cap realized it was his turn to talk, after the Fed had debriefed them on the interview with McKee, and Junior had instructed Rawls to bring in Alex Cheney for questioning. He tapped his fingertip on the fast-forward button on the recorder and gave them the highlights. After Kylie leaves with Marsh, McKee and Dina give Bailey some food and water and tell her she's going home soon. So she does what they tell her for 2 days. She notices they nod off on the couch around the same time every night. I'm guessing that's when they shot up or took their Vicks or whatever. So on the third night, she waits until they're asleep and then tries getting out the back door. McKee comes to and catches her, ties her by the wrist to the bed with an extension cord. She said he and Dina started fighting, fed her less, kept her tied up and made her pee in a cup. That was the last 2 days. Then we showed up. "Did she hear Marsh say anything about the man with the money?" said Trainer.
Cap held his fingertip to the fast-forward button.
"Just one thing," he said.
He let go, clicked up the sound.
"I know this is hard," said Cap on the recorder. "Was Kylie upset to leave you when she and Evan left?"
"Yeah," said Bailey, sounding even younger and squeakier than 8 years old. "We were, like, hugging and crying."
Bailey's voice shook and rattled.
"Evan said it would be okay. He'd bring Kylie back soon and we could see our mom soon."
"What did Kylie say?"
"She told him she didn't want to leave me there in the cabin with John and Dina. And he was like, 'We'll be right back after we visit your friend.'"
Cap tapped the stop button. Trainer looked at the Fed, then Vega, then Cap. He shrugged and shook his head at the same time.
"Your friend," said Vega. "Yes," Cap said. "Bailey, quoting Marsh, who says, 'your friend,' to Kylie." "I heard that," said Trainer. "You're thinking that means Kylie knows the money man?"
"Maybe," said Cap. Trainer turned to the Fed and nodded.
"Easily a slip of the tongue or memory," said the Fed. "It's a stretch." "Sure," said Cap. "Stack it up, is all I'm saying."
Trainer waved his hand in the air directly above his head, reminded Cap of the white-wigged politicians in British Parliament he'd seen on TV.
"So noted," said Trainer, a red light flashing over his face. "Captain," he said to Junior, aggravated, "pull over and let all this pass."
Junior pulled over, and they all watched the caravan, the White's car containing Jamie and her parents and Aunt and Bailey, the lawyer's car close behind, 2 state police, 3 local, and then the news vans, 10 that had become 20 while the authorities had been conducting the interviews in the hospital. A helicopter cut the air above them, hanging low like a mosquito. Cap lowered his window, leaned his head out, and peered up, shutting one eye to the rough wind from the rotors. The sound amplified and became less choppy, turned into a booming rumble. There was something strangely peaceful about it. Cap had the feeling that if he closed his eyes and opened his arms, the gust might lift him up. He might rise and float. Until a voice or a car horn shocked him awake, brought him back down fast.
Chapter 16.
Vega watched the TV in the break room back at the police station, saw Jamie hobbling out of the hospital, clutching Bailey to her side, Sam, the lawyer, stepping between them and the cameras, then Hollows, Cap, herself. Her eye twitched when she saw her face on the screen, the gravel scratches and the bandage, the bruise around her eyebrow. It all looked worse than it felt, although now that the last of the drugs had worn off, the pain was manifesting as weariness. Joints and muscles cracked and stretched. She swallowed the rest of the room temp Lipton tea from the cup in her hand. Vega? It was Hollows in the doorway. He nodded at her, and she nodded at him, and the nods meant that she should follow him. They went to Trainer's office, where Vega felt like she had missed something. It was Trainer behind his desk and Cap leaning on the wall, the Fed and the Fed's boss, who was silver-haired and looked like a businessman instead of an agent. Tie clip, cufflinks, clean lines on the pants. He was tired in the face, though. Thin but swollen skin under the eyes and jawline. He spoke quietly.
"This is Miss Vega?"
"Yes, sir," said the Fed. "Miss Vega, this is my supervisor, Special Agent Gatlin."
Gatlin stood and shook her hand, glanced and read the screen on the tablet in his other hand.
"Miss Vega, I understand you shot and wounded a key witness in this investigation, and now she is unresponsive."
He did that question mark ending, reserved for lawyers and teenage girls. It was difficult to know if he actually wanted an answer. He closed the cover on his tablet.
"That's not the ideal outcome," he said to her, as if they were the only two in the room. "I imagine you'll have to appear before a grand jury at some point."
"Is this really your jurisdiction, sir?" said Cap, agitated. "Kaplan," said Trainer.
The Fed rubbed his eyes.
"No, let's just hold on," said Cap, coming off the wall. "You're coming in here and threatening my partner with indictment after she acted in self-defense in defense of a minor. We don't need that kind of help. She doesn't give a shit if she goes before a grand jury. She doesn't give a shit if she goes to jail."
Gatlin smiled thoughtfully, like he was doing math in his head, and said,
"What a relief that must be."
"Yes, it is," said Cap.
He patted his hand over the middle of his chest, flattening an invisible tie.
"It's fucking heavenly. So, sir, do you have anything you can bring to this case, or did you just come here to slap us on the wrist? Because if that's the case, however much the Bureau paid for your plane ticket, it seems like too much."
Vega knew he was tired, could hear the cords straining in his throat, could see his eyes watering as he got more and more pissed off. For just a second, the room was quiet and airless. And in that peculiar space, Vega thought of him unclasping her bra, and wondered if he could do it with one hand. Trainer coughed as an intro and said,
"Sir, we've all been working round the clock here, and I think what Mr. Kaplan is getting at is we've made it a point not to get caught up in digressions. Do you have anything new for us?"
"Just one thing," Gatlin said.
Not angry, no longer bemused. Vega got the impression nothing moved him much in any direction. He opened his tablet again and tapped the screen. He showed it to Trainer, but spoke to the room.
"We've been re-examining the Ashley Cahill and Sidney McKenna cases," he began.
"Re-examining?" said Cap. "Aren't they still open?"
Gatlin turned to him and poked his tongue around his cheek. Trainer touched one finger to his temple like he was about to tell the future. Vega felt a laugh shudder through her chest and throat. She kept her mouth shut tight.
"Yes, Mr. Kaplan, they are open, just a bit chilly. We found one more connection. Both Ashley and Sidney took ballet classes at small studios."
"So did Kylie," said Vega. Everyone thought about it.
"Yes," said Gatlin. "And all three of those studios used the same distributor, Moreland Athletics."
"So are we talking to them?" said Trainer.
"We are," said Gatlin. "We have a man there going through employee lists, looking at who has made deliveries or sales to all three locations."
"Wouldn't it be better to isolate Kylie Brant's first?" said Junior. "In the interest of time?"
"Can't be too many guys who have worked there over 4 years. in deliveries and sales in those three areas, said Vega.
That's exactly right. By looking at all three scenarios, Captain, we'll actually narrow our suspect list,
Gatlin said.
Moreland Athletics didn't come up in the ballet teacher's statement, far as I know, said Trainer, standing. While we're waiting for lists, let's cover it again. Everyone who works there. The suspect profile is someone with substantial disposable income. Probably male, probably Caucasian. Special Agent Gatlin, you and Special Agent Cartwright can accompany Captain Hollows to the location if you'd like to see it.
That's fine, said Gatlin, eyes on his tablet.
Vega, Cap, Alex Chaney's waiting for you.
Chaney was pacing and gnawing his fingertips when they came in. He wheeled around and shut his eyes in relief when he saw them.
Hey, you guys, could you guys tell them I didn't have anything to do with this? You know I didn't have anything to do with this. We talked about it. We had to sit down, Alex, said Cap.
He was past exhausted and anxious, and was now feeling like he had felt when Nell was a newborn and he was working certain cases. Awake, but not awake, when coffee didn't work anymore, and it was just sugar he wanted, candy and soda. Chaney dropped into the chair and put his thumbs and forefingers on his temples, making an awning out of his forehead. Cap sat across from him, and Vega stood behind Cap.
"You sell drugs to a guy named Evan Marsh," Cap said.
Chaney shivered and shrugged.
"Yeah, sure. Works at the Giant, right?"
"That's right," said Cap. "Now you need to think. The day Kylie came to see you, was Marsh there, too?"
Chaney looked back and forth between them, cornered.
"He got something to do with Kylie?"
Cap cut the air with his hand.
"Just listen to what I'm asking," he said. "The day Kylie came to see you, was Evan Marsh there?"
Chaney bit his lips so they disappeared.
"Yeah, I think so. I think that's right. I mean, it makes sense. Timing's right. Marsh comes by once a month toward the beginning."
"But you don't remember them talking to each other specifically, or anything like that?"
"No, man, I wanted to get her out of there. I said to her, stay here, in the corner with the cat. She was playing with my cat, and I went to get my keys and my jacket."
"So when you came back to the living room, was she still playing with the cat?"
"No," said Chaney. "She was talking to some of them, the dope heads, and I remember thinking she looked so much older than when I last seen her."
"Was one of them Marsh?" said Vega. Chaney gazed up to her, his eyes wandering around her face, registering her injuries.
I don't know. Maybe."
He looked back to Cap.
"I just wanted to get her out of there."
Cap tried to picture Chaney's house in daylight, tried to see Kylie there with the cat, talking to Marsh and whoever else.
"Does Marsh usually come to your place by himself?" Cap said. "Does he come with people?"
Chaney perked up, eager to answer.
"Yeah, he does," he said. "Lately, a guy named Bruce."
Cap scrolled through the list of Evan Marsh's known associates in his head, thought he remembered a Bruce. "Bartender, right?" said Vega. Chaney rapped his knuckles on the table.
"That's right, at Stag's."
"You got a number for him?" said Cap.
Chaney pulled out his phone and tapped some buttons. Vega put the number in her phone, and then Chaney looked up at both of them and sniffed dramatically.
"We'll walk you out," said Cap.
"That's it?" said Chaney,
looking like a kid who just found out he didn't have to get the flu shot.
"That's it," Cap said. "We don't have any questions or concerns regarding your small business aspirations. If you could keep track of your clientele, maybe work up a list for us of people who come to see you at the beginning of the month, that would be helpful."
"You got it, man," said Chaney.
He stood and made fists, unsure of how to process the energy. He made a sound like, whew, part sigh and part whoop. The three of them left the room, entered the second floor hallway, which was narrow and crowded with circles of cops. They headed for the stairs, And then Vega stopped short in front of Cap, and Cap put his hand up in reflex, felt the lats in her back turn to clay. And then Cap saw why. Junior holding Jamie Brandt's arm, coming up the stairs. Jamie started to smile when she saw Vega, but then her face hardened up when she caught sight of Chaney lurking behind Cap.
"The fuck is he doing here?"
she whispered.
"He's helping us," said Vega. "Helping you," said Jamie, incredulous. "He never helped anyone but himself. What do you know about anything?"
she said to him.
Chaney held his hands up. "I swear I'm here to help find her." "The fuck are you talking about? The fuck is he talking about?"
she said to Vega, her voice cracking into a shriek.
"We need to bring you up to speed, Jamie," said Cap.
"Yes, you goddamn do, Mr. Kaplan. I don't know anything that's going on right now. That's what I'm doing here. What are we doing to find Kylie? What's this asshole got to do with it?"
"Jamie," said Vega, "one thing, and then the other." Jamie blinked twice like Morse code, and Vega said it again more quietly. "One thing, and then the other." The words had a pacifying effect on Jamie while she considered the situation. She studied Vega's face, and the hallway took on the feel of a junior high basketball court before the free throw, all the parents holding their breath, hoping to hell the kid would make the shot. At a stoplight, Vega opened a small foil envelope and shook two Advils into her mouth, tasted the sugary coating in the back of her throat, and waited. The sun was starting to sink again, the temperature dropping fast after a deceptively warm day. Her window was open, and a burst of cold air shot through the car and hit the open cuts on her cheek. She thought of when her mother used to take her and Tommy to the Russian River, and they'd wade into the water, walking on a million pebbles, and then smooth, round rocks that seemed made to fit the arches of her feet. The water was cold, but she'd get used to it quickly, her body heat sinking to match it. But then the riverbed would drop off, and the plunge wouldn't startle Vega as much as the temperature of the water, which would turn to freezing cold, the real cold, enveloping her. And she'd realize this is what the river actually is. It is this cold, the kind that makes you blue. That's what she felt in the air now. And that's the problem with this whole coast, she thought. They tell you it's spring. They say out like a lamb, but it's still winter underneath. Barbs of ice packed deep in the dirt and gusts of Arctic air turning whipped cream wheels in the sky. The light went green, and Vega followed the GPS to Stag's Bar, a red brick building on a small street with houses on either side. There were two small windows and a Coca-Cola light box sign above the door, an American flag dancing around in the wind. Inside, the counter was U-shaped and white, and looked cheap and beat up under the fluorescence in the corkboard ceiling. There were three customers, two young guys together on one side talking to the bartender, one old man on the other. The bartender had illegible script tattooed up and down both forearms and drowsy eyes. He was not particularly tall or husky. They all gawked at her when she came in, none of them the least bit shy, the old man sipping his beer and staring at her face like he was watching a football game. The bartender walked away from the two young men, and they immediately erupted in laughter. The bartender glanced back at them and laughed too, in on the joke. He came toward Vega, smirking.
"What can I get you?" he said, shuffling his skater sneakers on the checkerboard floor.
"You Bruce Pastor?" said Vega.
He nodded up once. It was the who-wants-to-know nod.
"I'm Alice Vega," she said. "I left three messages on your phone."
Pastor snapped his head to the side.
"Battery's dead,"
he said, both hands on the bar.
"Who are you again?"
"My name's Vega."
I find missing persons. I'd like to ask you some questions about Evan Marsh, about a time you and he bought drugs from Alex Cheney a month ago. She could see Pastor hedging in the dimly lit hallways of his head. She could almost hear the idiot chorus lie to her.
I don't know either of those guys, he said, so I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm not a cop, she said. I don't care if you buy drugs or use drugs or if you're on drugs right now. I need to know if you remember seeing a little girl at Alex Cheney's house the last time you were there with Evan Marsh. Pastor was quiet. He was looking everywhere but at her eyes. Vega leaned over the bar. The little girl was Kylie Brandt, she said, close enough to his face to smell cinnamon gum. We found her sister this morning, but Kylie's still missing. I need to know what she and Evan Marsh talked about at Alex Cheney's house a month ago. The two guys in the back chattered away. Pastor looked over his shoulder at them, then turned back to Vega, pursing his lips, gathering spit to speak.
If you're not buying a drink, you're gonna have to leave.
Vega sighed. She could tell he felt kind of bad about it, but not bad enough to talk. He started to walk away, and Vega grabbed his wrist. Don't do this, she said. Please just tell me if you remember. He yanked his arm away and shrugged, and even that was lazy, his bony shoulders barely making the arch.
Sorry, girl, wasn't me.
Now he no longer felt bad about anything. Now he was just a kid who wanted to cover his ass, like a million kids before him wanting to cover their asses. He walked away from her, and she watched him go with his skinny boy slouch. He went back to talking with his friends, and they sputtered and laughed some more. Vega honestly couldn't determine if she was more angry or tired. Her face was tingling, but she was fairly sure it was the injuries and not ruthless rage. She stared at her hands, palms and tops, the dirt and blood packed under the nails, and thought of the day she had had. Then she saw the three boys at the end of the bar and tried to think of the day they had had. Probably woke up at noon and smoked weed and played Grand Theft Auto and jerked off. She looked at the old man on the other side of the bar, sipping his beer, and felt like him. Or felt like she imagined he was feeling, creaky and sore. Then she thought of Kaplan and his daughter. For some reason, she imagined him helping Nell with homework at the kitchen table. Vega actually doubted that Nell needed much help with anything, but still she pictured Cap standing over her while she worked on math or chemistry, something with definitely right and wrong answers, nothing wishy-washy. She thought of Nell getting it, drawing a neat box around a string of numbers and letters. Cap would say, "You see, Bug?" That's what he called her, wasn't it? "You don't even need me." And Nell would smile and say something smart. Maybe they would high-five. They would both be proud. Maybe Cap and Nell had not done that today, but whatever it was, no matter the detail, Cap and Nell were unequivocal in the decency of their lives. It ran through them like thread and colored everything they did. And these guys, well, how was she to know, really? Maybe they helped an old lady with her grocery bags and had run a tutoring session for at-risk kids today before they came here to get hammered at 5 p.m. But likely not. Vega stared at them, put a box around the answer. She moved slowly at first toward them, her right hand running along the bar, when she came to the taps. Yingling, Yingling Light, Bud, Bud Light. She made a fist and hit one after another, and down came the tired streams, one by one onto the rubber mat on the floor. It was only during a pause in their conversation that Pastor noticed the sound.
"What the fuck, girl?"
he said, managing to sound offended and hostile at the same time. And then he started to run. Vega picked up a highball glass in each hand and lobbed one at him. He caught it like she knew he would, so she fired the other one at his head. It hit him, and he screamed, probably more from the shock of it than the pain, though he went down anyway. The other two were coming at her fast, one taller than the other, both scrawny, and Vega thought she could fight one but not two, especially if they did that thing that boys were so fond of, where one held your arms back and the other took shots. And then there was the interest of time. So she pulled the Springfield from her holster and waved it at them casually. "Go away," she said. They both stopped where they stood. The tall one's jaw fell open like a puppet without a hand, but the short one was galvanized, high off the possibility of violence.
"I'ma call the cops on you and your busted-ass face, bitch," he said.
They lingered for a second, the short one rattling off imaginative threats punctuated with cunt and bitch, and didn't seem to be wrapping it up.
"Go away," she shouted,
this time aiming the Springfield at the short one's chest, and he finally shut up. They both ran out, the front door flying open, letting in the cold and the light for a second. Vega put her gun away. She jumped the bar, swung her legs around, and knocked over a few mugs. Pastor was trying to stand, still stunned, a thin line of blood trickling from his eyebrow. He was mostly moaning. The old man on the other side of the bar had not moved, still drank his beer.
"You got something to say, Poppy?" she said.
He put his mug down, pinched his upper lip to wipe the foam, and pointed at her.
"You remind me of my late wife," he said thoughtfully.
Vega was too distracted to laugh, so she nodded. Then she looked back down at Pastor, who was sitting up with his knees bent and his head down. He asked her to turn off the taps, so she did. One by one, the streams stopped, reminded her of ceiling leaks getting plugged. Then she sat on her heels next to Pastor, who thanked her before he told her everything he knew. Chapter 17 Cap sat with Jamie in Junior's office. As she listened to him, ruddy splotches appeared on her cheeks and forehead, tears spilling loosely from her sealed eyes. She rubbed them with her fingertips.
"Jamie, we're getting all the security video we can and canvassing the strip mall near the ballet studio," Cap said. "Do you remember anyone who stood out? A delivery person or a salesman, maybe?"
"No. It was just a strip mall, and it was just a ballet class. I don't remember a delivery guy,"
whispered Jamie, coughing. She smacked her forehead with her palm, gently.
"Part of me feels like I got Bailey. There's no way I'm gonna get Kylie, too, right? That's just too much luck."
Cap knew he should speak, but he couldn't think of anything that didn't sound patronizing.
"I just..." Jamie started. "I just think I could handle anything. I think I could live with just Bailey... if I had to. I just...
She kept breaking on the just. No new tears were coming. Her eyes were small and dry, her face wet like a stone.
I just couldn't handle it if they cut her up. You know, her body parts. I've thought about this a lot. Then... I'd do the overdose right. Bailey could live with my folks."
She touched her hair dreamily, still gazing past Cap as she thought about it. Cap stood up and saw confetti in the corners of his eyes, held the edge of the table with one hand, queasy.
"Wait here. I'll be right back," he said.
Jamie nodded, still spacey. Cap jogged out of the office, down one floor to the break room, fed dollars into the vending machine. Two packs of peanut M&Ms dropped to the tray, and Cap grabbed them and ran back upstairs to Jamie. She was still staring blankly ahead, resting her head on her fists, stacked on top of each other. "Here," said Cap, setting the candy on the desk in front of her. She raised her head and looked at the yellow bag like it was a rock from the moon. "Have you eaten any solid food yet?" Cap said, ripping open his own bag.
"Yeah, I had some toast and soup."
"Try a couple," he said. "They'll give you a little energy." He tilted his head back and poured some of the candy into his mouth and started crunching. Then the syrupy sweetness of mass-produced chocolate hit him, and he accidentally made a little grunting noise.
"You really like M&Ms," said Jamie,
opening her bag with two hands.
"The cheap sugar is the only thing that keeps me going when I'm this tired," he said. "Might help you, too."
"Kylie doesn't love anything like she loves sugar," she said. "I tell people that, and they're all, duh, she's a kid, but it's different. I have two kids, and Bailey loves ice cream and cake and Twizzlers as much as the next, but Kylie..."
She paused, shook her head, stared at the bag of candy in her hand.
"Go on," said Cap.
"I still have to stop her from sucking on ketchup packets when we get hot dogs. She puts them in her pocket. It's like a drug problem."
She set the bag down on Junior's desk.
"Do you think they actually lured her with candy, like the stuff they used to tell us when we were kids?"
Cap swallowed, and the candy went down rough, a collection of unchewed peanuts.
"This sounds a little more organized than that," he said, "which is good for us, actually. Random's usually harder to figure out."
Jamie nodded. She picked out one M&M, bright, unreal blue, and ate it. She closed her eyes and held it in her mouth for a good long time. In the big blue conference room, Vega connected her laptop to a projector, and the image, split into four, appeared on the beige screen, the parking lot of the strip mall on Church Street, the western entrance where the ballet studio was visible, in between a shoe store and a juice bar, the eastern entrance, and the rear parking lot for trucks making deliveries. The Fed and trainer stood and stared, watching footage in black and white, people coming and going.
"How'd your guy get this so quickly?" said the Fed.
"He has a talent," said Vega.
"Maybe you should come work for us," said the Fed, glancing back at his boss, who sat and drew delicate slashes with his fingertip on his tablet.
"He's an independent contractor," said Vega. "How far you want to go back? 6 months?"
6 months, said Cap. "Come on." "Let's start with one," said Trainer. "Emerson?"
Em sat near the head of the table, chugging an energy drink, surrounded by three officers still in their blues from their previous shift.
"Yes, sir, we'll each take a screen. Looking for a white male who shows up more than once, probably near or around the ballet studio. Anything that stands out. Anyone who looks familiar," said Cap. "The ballet instructor remember anything?" said Trainer, nodding to the Fed. "We talked to her for about an hour," said the Fed. "There's a guy who works for Moreland. Came in to measure mirrors a while back. She said she didn't like the way he looked at her and some of the older girls." "Was Kylie one of the older girls?" said Cap. "No. Oldest was 12. But that may not make a material difference to a pedophile," said the Fed. "Our man at Moreland is going through his records, trying to find the guy he sent to measure their mirrors. He'll send it as soon as he has it." "Does he need someone to help him along?" said Junior, annoyed. "I'm sure he's capable, Captain," said Trainer. "There's only nominal information in the McKenna and Cahill files about the ballet classes, so we should get the parents in here. The McKennas are on their way now." "Anything from neighboring businesses?" asked Trainer.
The Fed shook his head.
"Everyone's got a story. You ask people enough questions, they start to think the UPS guy looks suspicious." "Vega," said Trainer.
Pastor was with Marsh at Alex Cheney's the day Kylie was there. He didn't realize it was Kylie. In his memory, she only stood out because she was a little girl in a room full of dopers. He thought she was Cheney's kid sister or something, she said, glancing at the video feed. He remembers she told Marsh she wanted to be a movie star, and he asked her how old she was and where she went to school.
So he gives her his number? Said Cap. That doesn't seem plausible.
Vega shrugged. Who cares? She said softly, as if it were just the two of them in the room. He knew enough about her to find her. Name, school, Denville.
We've got people canvassing the strip mall on Church, said Trainer, charting maps in his head. Detectives and lieutenants calling the parents of the kids in the ballet class. Let's get prepared for the mirror, man.
We can do the interview, said Vega.
No, said Trainer definitively.
Vega stared at him, surprised, and Cap stiffened up, ready to fight. Really, Chief? She thought. Now we're taking our dicks out? Trainer swabbed at the air with his hands like they were windshield wipers, erasing it.
It'll take some time to get him ID'd and in the house. Let's put it to use. Sidney McKenna's parents should be here soon. Cap, Vega, why don't one of you talk to them? He said. What about Ashley Cahill's parents? Said Cap. They're divorced. Father lives in Philly, but the mother still lives in Lebanon, right outside. So we'll talk to her first, and then if we need to, go to the father. I want all of this face to face.
Vega got it. People thought more when you were in the room with them. They had better memories, consciences, and you could see their eyes. Trainer continued,
Apparently Mom can't leave the house. Says she's ill. Didn't sound so stable when I spoke with her.
Vega remembered lying in her bed in junior high and high school, falling asleep listening to Eminem or Black Flag on headphones, and then waking up long after the CD ended. How she'd hear her mother making her rounds around the house, checking doors and windows, murmuring the mantra of her neuroses.
Safe, safe, safe.
I'll go. I'll see Ashley Cahill's mother, she said then. So firm, so assured, you'd think she'd made the decision years ago. Cap's phone hummed and jumped with texts on the desk in front of him. He was in Trainer's office alone. Messages were stacking up, flashing at the top of the screen from people he knew and sort of knew, friends he hadn't talked to in a few years, and also his parents in Florida, his cousins, of course Nell, and even one from Jules, who usually only contacted him about logistics. The text said things like this,
Buddy, you are on CNN. I just saw you on the news. You look old.
Please call me. Dad is so proud, he says. XOXO, Mom. You and Alice are on every network. Any closer to finding Kylie?
Cap, be careful. That last one was from Jules, and Cap smiled at her use of punctuation, even in a text. Formal and academic, except with his name. When they'd been married, she called him Max, but after the split, on the rare days she actually used his name to address him, he was Cap. It sounded casual enough coming from anyone else, and from her it meant exactly that. She was anyone else now. Still, he stared at her text and felt something resembling joy. He wrote back a restrained,
Trying. Thanks for checking in.
Then he wrote to Nell, Don't stay up too lateral. The autocorrect button popping up. I wolfs. Sideways smiley face came back. Then the door opened, and it was Junior with a couple behind him.
Max Kaplan, Toby and Erica McKenna.
Cap shook their hands. They were both young and attractive, tan and brunette. The man, Toby, was tall, with a full head of thick hair and glasses, his wife petite, with a perfectly oval face. They all sat in a small circle of chairs Cap had arranged, because he hadn't felt comfortable sitting behind the chief's desk.
Thank you for coming, said Cap, especially so late.
Happy to do it,
said Toby McKenna, his voice deep. With the small circle frames on his glasses, Cap thought he was a twin for Clark Kent.
I realize this can't be easy.
Neither responded to that. Both smiled politely, looked at their hands and each other. Even unnerved, their faces retained their clean beauty. There were plenty of young parents in and around Denville. Cap found it to be a function of the suburbs. People had bigger houses, more rooms than they did in cities, so they filled them up with kids. This was not what he had experienced growing up in Sheepshead Bay. When Cap was 4 or 5 and begged his mother for a little brother, she'd said, "Where are we going to put him, Maxie? The bathtub?" He grew up with pots and pans stacked on top of one another in cupboards that could never quite close, the fan of handles jutting from the doors. Later, he found out his mother'd had her tubes tied when he was a year old. "We don't have the money, and he's just about perfect," his mother had said to his father. "Why tempt fate?" But around here, you had kids, and you had them young, and you had a few. Even knowing that, though, Cap thought the McKennas looked awfully young to have an oldest child who was 12 years old. He put their age at about 30, so of course it was possible that they'd had kids in high school or right after. There was something off-center about them. He couldn't quite pin it down. He remembered from the file that Toby McKenna had been driving for a livery car service in Harrisburg at the time of the abduction. But Cap didn't read that now. Not from the brown leather shoes with a black rubber outsole, tan blazer, Clark Kent build, and glasses with designer frames.
"Mr. McKenna, can I ask, are you still working for the black car service? What was the name again?" he said. "No, not Elite Fleet, not anymore," said McKenna, adjusting his glasses shyly.
Humbly dapper, Cap couldn't help but think.
"We opened. Me and Erica were able to open our own service a year ago in Middletown. A few cars, a few drivers, catering to high-end clients."
He said it quickly, made Cap think it was something he didn't want to dwell on.
"I see,"
Cap said, smiling, friendly.
"Going well, I hope? Always tricky with a small business. Believe me, I know." "Yes, it's going okay,"
said McKenna, quick again. "We've been very lucky," added Erica McKenna. "Right place at the right time." She smiled then, and Cap saw a twinge cross her face. For a moment, it looked as if she might cry.
"I'm pleased to hear it," Cap said. "If anyone deserves it, it's you folks."
They both nodded, looked down and away, shutting the door on pain, or hiding something, or both.
"So," Cap said, "I'll get right to it here so you can go back to your lives and your family."
He leaned forward and rested his forearms on his knees, clasping his hands to show them. This is a conversation, not an interrogation.
"We have reason to believe that Kylie Brandt's kidnapper had some kind of connection to her through her ballet class initially. Ashley Cahill in Lebanon also took ballet, and I understand Sydney did as well. That right?"
"Yes," said Erica. Her husband nodded.
"I guess what we just need to know here is if you remember anything strange surrounding the ballet class in particular. Did you take her to ballet generally, Mrs. McKenna?"
"Yes," said Erica again.
"Great. Let's start with the teacher. Her name was in the file."
Cap reached behind them and grabbed the folder, opened it.
"Nancy Topper?"
"Miss Nancy, they called her, all the girls."
"Miss Nancy," repeated Cap. "Anything seem off with her? Anything stand out?"
"No, I don't think so," said Erica, glancing at McKenna. "Sid liked her well enough."
"Okay," said Cap. "Now, can you recall anything that didn't seem right at the class? Or maybe where the class took place? At the..."
He flipped through the pages of the file, searching for the name.
Junior Tiptoes Dance Studio?
Erica shook her head, appeared confused. I'm sorry, like what?
Anything, said Cap.
Still, they both looked at him with blank faces.
I apologize, I'll be a little more specific. Do you remember anyone else, besides Miss Nancy, who was in and out of the studio and may have seen Sydney? A delivery man, a salesman, someone who worked in a nearby business?
Erica gripped the small purple handbag in her lap. No, she said, sounding genuinely sad. I'm sorry, I just don't remember anyone like that.
The police asked us all these kinds of questions when she first disappeared, added McKenna. We made lists of all the people, all the parents of the other kids, names, numbers.
I understand, said Cap, holding his hands up.
And again, I'm sorry to have to rehash this. It's just that we can't take anything as a coincidence right now. And three little girls who all took ballet, and the same equipment distributor serviced all three ballet studios, it's something we noticed.
Cap flipped through the pages in the folder and didn't speak for a minute. He wanted to see if the McKennas might offer up anything else without his prompting. The thing about it was, he believed what they were saying, both of them. But he could not shake the feeling of a bad tooth decaying in the gums. That's when he saw the picture. It was a Christmas card showing the whole family, a glossy green strip with all of their smiling faces, the girls in green dresses, the boy made to wear a sweater vest, and McKenna and Erica, both at least 20 or 30 pounds heavier. Their tragedy explained the weight loss easily, but their faces were different, too. Erica's nose now smaller and turned up at the end, while in the picture it was longer and thicker. McKenna's eyes now wide without a wrinkle, while for that Christmas, tired and furrowed, after undoubtedly driving a third shift hack. In Cap's experience, it was seldom that parents looked better and healthier after losing a child. Yet here the McKennas were, right in front of him, 2 years after their 8-year-old had vanished, looking like superheroes on their off day. It was close to 10 when Vega pulled into Laurel Acres Mobile Home Park Estates, which sounded to her like the result of a word jumble game. The GPS continued to announce she had reached her destination because the roads of the park were not registered on any map except its own internal directory. Now she was going from the notes on her phone, given to her by Hollows, who'd gotten them from Ashley Cahill's mother. The roads were paved, set out in a grid, 2 or 3 lots per block, all the homes raised on concrete foundations, built long and narrow. Most were in decent shape with fresh vinyl siding, flower boxes under perfectly square windows. Vega found the street and then the number. There was no curb or driveway, so she turned in and parked perpendicular to the house, next to an old hatchback. She got out, saw that the place looked the same as the others, more or less. Blue-gray in color, dim lights on inside, a blue bulb over a screened porch. She went up the steps, pulled back the screen door, and stood on the porch, a blank wiry mat under her feet. She pressed the doorbell and waited. Cool air blew through the screen and went right into her ears, a sharp little sting. The woman who opened the door had milk-white hair pulled back in a ponytail, wore a sleeveless jersey dress with bare legs and feet underneath. Her eyes were such a dark brown they were almost black. She puckered her lips, chewing gum, Vega assumed. She said, "You're someone else." Vega paused, then said, "Alice Vega. The guy I talked to said he'd send someone else, meaning not him." "Yes, Hollows, right?" "Yeah, that's it." "And you're Stacy Gibbons?" said Vega. "Yeah,
used to be Cahill. I'm her, said Stacy, moving the gum to her molars, jaw clicking and clamping. You can come in.
Vega stepped inside, and Stacy moved behind her to shut and lock the door. Like the whole park, everything was laid out in neat squares here. The living room first, with an L-shaped couch, fit perfectly to one corner and its walls, leading into the square of the dining room with a square glass table. There was nothing on the table except an empty bowl in the middle. Vega glanced around and saw every table and surface was the same. No knick-knacks, cups, magazines. Her eyes jumped to paintings on the wall. Nondescript flowers in vases, a sailboat on a calm sea. They reminded her of pictures hanging in a hotel room.
It came like this, said Stacy, reading Vega's mind. Furniture and everything. My ex gave me the down payment, so I'd stay away from him and his new wife.
She glanced around the room, then, and added, It worked. She studied Vega quickly, head to feet and back up again.
The guy, Hollows, said there wasn't anything new about Ashley. This is about those other girls up in Denville.
That's right, said Vega. Stacy did some short nods, continued to work the gum in her mouth, pursing and relaxing her lips.
Okay, then. You can have a seat.
Vega sat on one side of the L, Stacy on the other. The jersey dress hiked up a bit, revealing bald, bruised knees. Stacy didn't make a move to cover herself, didn't seem to notice. She tried to keep her hands in her lap, but was having some trouble doing so, rubbing her thumbs between fingers like she was kneading a knot of dough in each hand.
You think it's the same guys whoever took Ashley?
She said. Maybe, said Vega. I want to ask you a couple of questions about her ballet class. Kylie Brandt also took ballet. We're thinking the kidnapper might have seen or gotten to know the girls that way. Stacy pressed her front teeth against her bottom lip. Vega could see her temples pulse.
Like a stalker? Said Stacy. Someone stalking ballet classes for kids?
Yes, maybe. Does anything come to mind?
No,
she said, right away. Shook her head and kept shaking it. She had voluntarily removed herself from remembering, Vega knew. Nothing on the walls. Nothing on the shelves. Do you have any pictures of her taking ballet? Or a video of a performance, maybe? Anything I could look at that might help me? Said Vega. Stacy stopped shaking her head suddenly.
You mean something that might help me, don't you?
She said, popping her jaw down. Maybe, said Vega.
You probably think I got rid of all of Ashley's things just because I don't have pictures of her everywhere.
Vega didn't respond.
You're wrong, Stacy said. I have everything. Everything. I have her hair. I have her underwear. I just don't have it out here. Because of this.
She pointed to her jaw, clamping and unclamping, still. She opened her mouth. White teeth. A salmon-colored tongue. There was no gum. There had never been gum.
I tried putting pictures of her up. I'd look at them and get muscle spasms or pass out. Nod my teeth down to stubs. Then I got a shit ton of meds so I can operate in the world, but I still do this 24/7, 365,
she said, tapping her jaw again. They were quiet. The only sound, the clicking of Stacy's teeth. She had an aggressive spark just then. Vega thought she might jump up and bite her. She thought of what Cap would do and started talking. She thought of her mother.
"People pay me a ridiculous amount of money to find their kids," she said. "They come to me and they're out of their minds. So I find them. Most of them. And the parents either live their own lives and hope that works out for their kids, or they live their lives for their kids.